Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Nicki Minaj and the case of the Sorry Sample. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry stories of the last week, a week when about 6 months worth of TikTok news came all at once.
It has been a very busy week for TikTok news, to the extent that by the time this podcast goes out, who knows what else will have happened? Because there will be, what, about 48 hours between us recording this podcast and this podcast going live. And if the last week is anything to go by, a lot could happen in the world of TikTok in those 2 days.
It's all to play for.
It is all to play for. By the time this podcast goes out, who knows? It could be that Asda owns TikTok.
Yeah.
Which would be an interesting turn of events, wouldn't it?
In a roundabout way.
For all the cool kids. It might be that you get a free TikTok video with every 6 packs of, I don't know, bread rolls you buy from Asda by the end of the week. Or alternatively, it could be that everybody who even thinks about using TikTok within the jurisdiction of the United States might be locked up and the keys thrown away by Donald Trump and his army of sinister army-like people. It could be either of those things could have happened. So we don't know. Basically, by the time you're listening to this podcast, we've no idea. Is TikTok still in business? Is it still available in the US? Is it owned by somebody different? Is it having any impact on TikTok outside the US, in the UK? What about the ban in India? There's an awful lot of TikTok news. If you're interested, I suggest you check out the latest edition of the CMU Daily. I'm sure we'll update you on there. And if you're not interested, you might need to unsubscribe from the CMU Daily. Because that seems to be all we're writing about at the moment. Oh, no, we're still writing about the whole Apple v Fortnite thing as well. So,
yes.
If you're interested
in that as well.
If you're interested in, you know, music business news rather than gaming news and video social sharing app news, then maybe the CMU Daily is no longer the bulletin you should be signing up to. Although there have been some music business developments this week, and that is actually what we're here to talk about, I believe.
Yes, I mean, as we just sort of hinted at, the two biggest stories of the week are TikTok and Fortnite. But one, I mean, neither of them are exactly music industry news. Also, they're both changing so quickly that there's just no point recording a podcast now, only for it to be out of date in 2 days' time. So, yes, that is not what we're here to talk about this week, but I will link to all those stories in the show notes as they currently stand. But for now, later on in this episode, we will be discussing the big row over Rule Britannia. But first, Tracy Chapman's legal battle with Nicki Minaj got interesting last week when Chapman's lawyers claimed that Minaj's lawyers were ignoring both facts and the law when it came to presenting their arguments. In particular, they say that Minaj is failing to even acknowledge the key matter that the whole case rests upon, that being that Minaj went out of her way to get a track containing an uncleared Chapman sample played on the radio.
Yes, so what began its life as a pretty run-of-the-mill sample dispute has become quite interesting with the more recent legal filings. So interesting, in fact, that maybe we ought to recap what we're talking about and go back to October 2018, which is when Tracy Chapman first sued Nicki Minaj over a track that has actually never been properly released. It's a track called Sorry that was meant to appear on Nicki Minaj's 2018 album Queen, but it was dropped from that album at the very last minute because her people could not get permission to use a Tracy Chapman sample that was in that track. It's a sample of Chapman's song Baby Can I Hold You. Now, even before October 2018 and the lawsuit being filed, we actually knew that there were some licensing issues going on, and we knew that Tracy Chapman was the sticking point when it came to getting this track Sorry out there, because Nicki Minaj had been narrating all of this as the final preparations for the album Queen was being made on Twitter, basically saying to her fans, the album is ready, but there's this one track that's got a Tracy Chapman sample. I can't get that cleared. My people can't get that cleared. And then basically the Twitter conversation had two sides to it. First of all, she was begging the famously anti-sampling Tracy Chapman to get in touch. I think the hope being that while Nicki Minaj's management team and record label couldn't clear this sample, maybe if Nicki could talk to Tracy directly, she'd be able to sort it. But then also basically saying to her fans, the entire album's ready to go. This sample issue is holding the whole thing up. What do you think I should do? Should I just release the record without that track? Or should we wait and see if we can get the sample cleared? She didn't wait very long. She did release the album without this track on it. And if that had been the end of the sorry story, then we wouldn't be talking about this now. But it didn't end with Nicki Minaj saying on Twitter, I'm going to release this record without this Tracy Chapman sampling track, because as you alluded to, what happened next is as the album came out, that unreleased track, Sorry, with the Tracy Chapman sample, got played on the radio.
Yes, and because Nicki Minaj had been talking about it so much in public, a lot of people noticed when that happened. So it was played on Funk Flex's show on the New York radio station Hot 97 FM the day after the album was released without the track on it. Some of the people listening did radio rips of the track and started circulating it online, all of which led to Chapman's copyright infringement lawsuit 2 months later, accusing Minaj of both creating an illegal derivative work and distributing that work.
So yes, the litigation kicked off, you know, within a couple of months of the album coming out. And then last year, Nicki Minaj's legal team formally responded to that lawsuit in a legal filing that had some common comebacks to cases of this kind. There were some tedious technicalities about how Baby Can I Hold You had been registered with the US Copyright Office. And then there was some stuff about how this track hadn't been released. It had only been played on the radio once, which meant that Nicki Minaj hadn't made any money out of the track. Tracy Chapman hadn't lost any money out of the track. And then there was the customary fair use defense, with Minaj's lawyers saying, pretty sure that whatever you're accusing our client of is probably covered by fair use, because that's what lawyers in American copyright cases always say.
So that was Minaj's legal team's first response to the lawsuit last year. But earlier this month, there was another filing from their side, which went a bit deeper into their fair use rights claims. They basically argued that artists playing around with uncleared samples behind closed doors in the studio is common practice and constitutes fair use under US copyright law. And saying otherwise, they claim, would set a dangerous precedent.
Yes, and in many ways, it was that legal filing earlier this month by the Nicki Minaj side that made this case much more interesting. Because although, as we say, they had talked a little bit about fair use in their initial response to Tracy Chapman's lawsuit, as you would expect, because they always do in cases like this. Fair use, of course, being the relatively ambiguous concept under American copyright law that says that in a whole bunch of scenarios, you can actually make use of copyright-protected works without the copyright owner's permission, because to do so is fair. But in the legal filing earlier this month, they dug into all of that in a lot more detail. And basically what they were saying was, in Tracy Chapman's lawsuit, she says that Nicki Minaj infringed her copyright by creating an illegal derivative work by taking Tracy Chapman's sample and putting it into her song, Sorry, and that that's copyright infringement. But what Minaj's side was saying was, well, hang on a second, we never released this track, remember? So you're saying that an artist going into the studio and messing around with an existing track in order to sample it in the studio as part of the creative process, you're saying that's copyright infringement. But that can't possibly be copyright infringement, because artists, particularly hip-hop artists, are doing that all of the time. It's part of the creative process as a hip-hop artist to go into the studio, access all the music in the world, usually these days through Google, and download it all and play around with it in the studio, create tracks, and then if you like what you've created, at that point and only at that point do you then get your management team or your label or whoever to then say, okay, what have we sampled here, what have we utilized, and then you go off and get the permission from the copyright owners of whatever it is you've sampled in order to use it in the track. And so basically what they were saying was, that's incredibly common practice within the music industry. That surely must come under the fair use exception under American copyright law. So Tracy Chapman's teams are wrong to say that that is copyright infringement. And you mentioned the dangerous precedent, another cliche that we get in lawsuits like this. They were basically saying if Tracy Chapman was allowed to win this lawsuit, then that would basically be saying that the way that all hip-hop artists work is copyright infringement, and that will completely screw up the creative process used by the whole hip-hop community. Was the slightly bombastic claims being made by the Nicki Minaj side in its legal filing earlier this month. And then what happened last week was we then got a response to that from the Tracy Chapman side. Two elements to that response. The first basically took issue with all of the Minaj side's fair use arguments and was basically saying you might be able to present a long, 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 long list of examples of hip-hop artists messing around with samples in the studio without first getting permission. That may be common music industry practice. But, they said, you will struggle to find any case law, any precedents in court that back up your definition of fair use and saying that fair use should apply in this circumstance. That was one part of the latest legal filing from the Tracy Chapman side. But more importantly than that, and I must admit, when I read the Nicki Minaj side legal filing earlier this month, I was confused about something. And it was very pleasing this week to see Tracy Chapman's lawyers basically saying in their latest filing, we're very confused about this because all you've talked about is Nicki Minaj messing around with samples in the studio and whether or not that's covered by fair use or whether or not there's grounds for copyright infringement, blah, blah, blah. That's an academic debate. Maybe we could have that academic debate at some point. But the whole point is that that isn't all that Nicki Minaj did because, as we said at the outset, she also sent a copy of the finished track, sorry, with the Tracy Chapman sample to a radio DJ to get it played on the radio. Or at least that is what Tracy Chapman team are very much alleging in quite some detail in this latest legal filing.
Yes, I think the point they wanted to make that it wasn't just the case that a radio DJ managed to get hold of this track somehow, no one's really sure how. They're saying that it was Nicki Minaj who went out of her way to make sure that this track was played on the radio. So they say in their latest filing that having been denied a license to sample Chapman's song twice, Minaj then got in touch with Funk Flex, whose real name is Aston Taylor, via her verified Instagram account. She told the DJ that Sorry would not be getting an official release for licensing reasons, but asked him nevertheless to play the finished track on his radio show. She then got in touch with Nas, who had collaborated with her on the track, and the sound engineer Aubrey Delane about getting a final version of Sorry mastered and signed off by Nas before she texted that track to Taylor, who played it on his show on the 11th of August, 2018. And Minaj's lawyers have previously said that one play on the radio is hardly worth filing a whole lawsuit over. However, Chapman's legal team say that that one radio play led to numerous radio rips being circulated online. As a result, they say Chapman has incurred significant costs monitoring the appearance of the track online and filing DMCA takedown notices to get it removed from wherever it pops up on the internet. And still, it continues to pop up in places on the internet. So the debate, they say, isn't really about whether or not Minaj should have been playing around with an uncleared sample behind closed doors, but more whether or not she should have shared that track with a radio presenter on the understanding that he would play it on air, despite knowing that the track contained an unlicensed sample.
Now, as I say, it seemed odd that the legal filing from the Minaj side earlier this month kind of glossed over the radio play of the track. I mean, it mentioned it, but it didn't go into it in any great detail, and it focused entirely on the possibility that the Tracy Chapman lawsuit, if successful, could have an impact on what artists can and cannot do with samples, etc., in the studio. Even though it seemed to me that the radio play and Minaj's alleged role in getting the track played on the radio is the fundamental of the case. And that's basically what Chapman's people were saying this last week. You've completely ignored the most important part of the case. And in doing so, all the arguments that you made in your filing this month, which Chapman's lawyers would add, we disagree with anyway, but they're all irrelevant because you've ignored the most important point. But I do think, and this actually alludes back to something we were talked about on last week's set list when we were talking, I think it was about 50 Cent and Rick Ross, wasn't it? We were talking about their little legal squabble. In that, in the same way that what Minaj's side are saying with regards samples being played around with in the studio, and they're basically saying that's incredibly common practice in the hip-hop community and it would be mad to say that copyright law should stop that, I think to a certain extent, although this position is less defendable, I think, but to a certain extent, you kind of think something similar has happened when it comes to getting the track played on the radio, in that I think in the music industry, and particularly in the hip-hop community, a distinction is often made when it comes to copyright matters between music that is commercially released and therefore has a direct financial reward for the artist and the label, etc., versus music that is put out there as promo. And what we were talking about on last week's set list was the whole mixtape phenomenon. The fact that lots of rappers and hip-hop artists, they put out mixtapes online full of uncleared samples and tracks, etc., out onto the internet. Everybody does that. It's seen as a standard way that you promote a new hip-hop artist, or when an established artist has a new record out, the mixtapes flow around on the internet. And basically, everyone turns a blind eye to that, because lots of hip-hop artists are sampling or putting in the mix other hip-hop artists, and it would be hypocritical for one artist to criticise another artist when everybody does it. Also, often, even when they're sampling music or they're playing records which sample music that isn't hip-hop, it's often controlled by major labels who are also releasing the albums that the mixtapes are promoting. So it would be hypocritical of everybody to start having an issue with things like mixtapes.
Yeah, so from a hip-hop perspective, copyright issues really only kick in when you want to commercially release something, and that's when you'd go and get your samples cleared. But if a mixtape's something you're putting out online for free, it's kind of thought of as like, well, that's fair game, really. And that's possibly what Minaj was thinking when she allegedly sent this to a radio DJ. She was like, well, I can't put it on my album, but I want people to hear this track, so I'll just let it be played on the radio, and then that'll be fine, because no one's earning any money off that. It's just a bit of fun. And Tracy Chapman did not agree with that. And I'm not sure copyright law would agree with that either.
No, and that's where I think the case becomes interesting, because on both the messing around with samples in the studio point and the sending a record to a radio DJ to get a little bit of airplay point, in essence, what we're seeing here is common practice in the music industry being pitched against what copyright law actually says. And just because the music industry may choose on a very regular basis to turn a blind eye to music being used without permission, because that's what we do, doesn't mean that that's what copyright law says. Now, as I've kind of alluded to already, I have to say, in terms of copyright being powerful enough to stop people playing around with samples behind closed doors, I think Minaj's team would be right to say that that doesn't seem right, that it is, you know, so common practice that in studios we all mess around with music. That's so part of the creative process to suggest that copyright law could somehow stop that, so that, you know, when an artist goes into the studio, they have to type out a list of all the music they might want to sample and then find out the copyright owners and get permission in advance, even though they may not actually do anything with that. I mean, that is ridiculous. Copyright law can't possibly demand that to happen. So
it seems like it would be very hard to enforce that as well.
Given that, and also samples are a nightmare to license at the best of times. So clearly that's unworkable. And on that point, I would say the Minaj team are right. Now, whether or not a strict interpretation of fair use under American copyright law applies to that, I suspect that it probably would. But okay, I don't know. Maybe the Chapman team are right to say that even if that does happen and should be allowed to happen, it's not necessarily true that copyright law allows it. But when it comes to the airplay thing, that's where I can see that plenty of people, particularly in hip hop, would say, what's the problem with that? We do that all the time. But on that point, I would definitely agree with the Chapman side that copyright law will almost certainly say, we don't care if this is commonplace in the music industry. Copyright law generally is quite clear that merely putting music out in public, playing it, making it available, that is covered by copyright. And if you do that without permission, that is copyright infringement. I'm pretty sure copyright law is quite certain on that. And to be honest with you, I don't think that's as problematic. If the conclusion in this lawsuit is Minaj didn't do anything wrong when she messed around with samples in the studio, but she shouldn't have sent the record to the radio DJ, and in doing so, that's where she infringed copyright, I don't think that sets any dangerous precedent, which obviously is what the Minaj side are trying to say here. They're trying to say, oh, be very careful here. This is going to screw everything up for all hip-hop artists everywhere. But if the outcome of this is, if you can't clear a sample on a track, don't send it to radio stations to play, I don't see that's that big a problem.
So it remains to be seen how Minaj now responds, both to the Chapman site's allegations regarding radio play of Sorry and the accompanying copyright debates.
But whatever they say, I think we'll be following this case quite closely in the CMU Daily and here on Setlist, unless they now settle, as they all...
Oh, they will, won't they?
They probably will, but assuming they don't, as I say, it's... Yes, on one level, just another sample case. We have lots of those. But some interesting arguments about when music industry practice conflicts with copyright law, and I find that quite interesting.
And finally, there was some classic BBC controversy last week when it emerged that the broadcaster was thinking of leaving two pieces of music out of its Last Night of the Proms concert, simply because some people thought that joyously singing about colonialism and slavery is offensive.
Yes, although before we get too far into this story, maybe for our international listeners, we should...
Our former subjects.
briefly explain what the BBC Proms are. And, well, I mean, officially, the BBC Proms is a festival of concerts, mainly classical and orchestral music, that take place over a couple of months, organised and broadcast by the BBC, a great programme of events that take place in London for fans of classical music and orchestral music. Although, if you ask the average British person what the Proms are, they probably wouldn't say that. They would probably refer to what is technically the last night of the Proms, which, pretty self-explanatory, is the final concert of the Proms programme, which happens every year, Last Night of the Proms. That's the event that most people associate with the Proms. And whereas the rest of the festival varies greatly from year to year as to what composers and what music is showcased, I guess to an extent that final concert, the Last Night of the Proms, has a pretty similar formula most years.
Yeah, I mean, it results in the most commonly seen and I guess thought of image of the Proms, which is some wankers waving flags.
So the Royal Albert Hall in London, full of people who wouldn't have gone to any of the concerts that happened earlier in the Proms, aren't interested in any of the other concerts that happened earlier in that year's Proms festival, but which enjoy going to the Royal Albert Hall and having some classical music they've actually heard of being played, in particular those pieces of classical music that are seen as being very British and about Britain, and therefore singing them while waving a Union flag is seen as being very patriotic. And yeah, that's what a lot of people will associate with the Proms, the Last Night of the Proms. And yeah, specifically the bit of the Last Night of the Proms when people are singing songs like Rule Britannia, Land of Hope and Glory, Jerusalem, and of course the national anthem, that being God Save the Queen, in case you wondered, and waving lots of flags and all being very proud to be British. That is what the Last Night of the Proms is all about. Or it was.
Yeah, it'll be a little bit different this year for two reasons. One, that, there's this COVID-19 thing, and so none of the Proms concerts this year are taking place with audiences. It's just the musicians playing them in the concert hall, and then they're broadcast on BBC Radio and TV. And the other issue is, I mean, this isn't even a new debate, but there's long been debate about Rule Britannia and Land of Hope and Glory, which form part of the traditional closing of the Last Night of the Proms concert, and whether or not their lyrics are appropriate in modern times. And that debate's been happening this year, particularly in the context of the recent Black Lives Matter protests. And it's, Rule Britannia is the one that's particularly difficult because it's kind of a celebration of the British Empire and its dominance over the countries that the British invaded between the 16th and 18th centuries. Notably, there's a description of those countries being haughty tyrants, and the line, of course, Britons never, ever, ever shall be slaves, basically because we're so big and tough, we're good at forcing other people into slavery, which it's fair to say we were.
Hence why It was felt in the past that that's something we should be celebrating through song. But as you say, in more recent years, lots of people have been saying it kind of feels wrong to be having these big sing songs of these lyrics in the 21st century. So maybe it's time to get rid of these songs out of The Last Night of the Proms and not have them as part of this big BBC event. Actually, there have been years when Royal Britannia and Land of Hope and Glory weren't part of The Last Night of the Proms. So, for example, in 2001, the Last Night of the Proms happened just a few days after the 9/11 attacks on New York. And as a result of that, it was felt that a more somber concert should probably take place. And as a result of that, Royal Britannia and Land of Hope and Glory were not featured that year. The following year, Land of Hope and Glory was returned, but Royal Britannia wasn't until 2008. So there have been Last Nights of the Proms concerts in the past that haven't had either or both of these songs within it, although they have been in there for the last 10 years. But yes, there was some debate earlier this month as to whether or not this year both of those pieces of music should be kicked out of the concert entirely, and there was speculation that it was going to be. Then the BBC came out and said, no, we found a compromise. Not that anyone really was asking for a compromise, but the compromise is that the music of Land and Hope and Glory and Rule Britannia will be played, but they won't have anybody singing alongside the music. And as we said, because there's no audience there this year, there'll be no audience to sing either. So people may sing along at home, but in terms of the official concert, it will just be the music. There will be no words. And so that is seen as a compromise, although, well, it's kind of a compromise that hasn't pleased anybody. There's still lots of people really angry that there will be no sing-along of Royal Britannia and Land of Hope and Glory at this year's Last Night of the Proms.
Yeah, I'm not sure any of those people are either people who don't work for or read the Daily Mail, but apparently, yeah, some people are upset because it's just infringing on our traditions and making us change for no reason except that the world has changed and we no longer have an empire and slavery isn't our main industry anymore. But apart from that, no reason at all.
Confirming its compromise, the BBC said in a statement that the changes it was making will reinvent the last night in this extraordinary year so that it respects the traditions and spirit of the event whilst adapting to very different circumstances at this moment in time. Although it later, partly under pressure from those people who pretended they were outraged about this, said that that was for this year, 2020, which, as they've noted, a bit of an odd year, and that the words, the vocals, the sing-song would probably return, or certainly return, at future Last Nights of the Proms.
Yeah, they said they'd be back next year, so I assume the debate will be back again next year. We did. One person who commented was British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Despite him not having commented on any of the actual crises the country faced in the last few weeks, this he felt was worthy of coming out of hiding for. But he said, I cannot believe that the BBC... That's his voice, by the way. I cannot believe that the BBC is saying that they will not sing the words of Land of Hope and Glory in Royal Britannia as they traditionally do at the end of the last night of the proms. I think it's time we stopped our cringing embarrassment about our history, about our traditions, and about our culture, and we stop this general fight of self-recrimination and wetness.
So there you go.
Perfect Boris impression there for you.
The Prime Minister has unusually, as you note, in the current climate, commented on this story, very angry about the BBC's decision.
Now, you could argue back to Boris that you can be aware of your history and also not sing joyously about it. But I'm not sure that's really an argument worth having, because obviously the different circumstances that the BBC was referring to were not that people think racism is bad this year. It's because there's this COVID-19 thing happening, which you would think Boris, of all people, would be aware of, because he's had it. And also, he is the leader of the country. So, you know, maybe it's sort of his job to realise that choirs spitting everywhere, even if you don't have an audience, is not a good thing. I mean, they're big choirs sing those songs as well. So you would just have a lot of people spitting all over the place. And yeah, I don't think that's a good thing.
Well, they could all have Union Jack face masks, couldn't they? That would sort of be in the spirit of
I think that might hinder their singing somewhat, but maybe.
Personally, don't care if Rule Britannia's kicked out. Don't really have much time for Rule Britannia. I do quite like Land of Hope and Glory. But maybe somebody could write some different lyrics. I don't know. It's very... I do like Land of Hope and Glory.
It's less bombastic than Rule Britannia, isn't it? Rule Britannia's just a bit... I mean, they both get the flag waving, but Rule Britannia's is a bit over the top. And it's obviously the lyrics, as we've said, are a little bit more controversial than Land of Hope and Glory.
Personally, I would go one step further. Keep Land of Hope and Glory. I like Land of Hope and Glory. But I'd get rid of the national anthem. What's the point of our national anthem?
I don't think... I mean, we haven't discussed that. That hasn't been part of the controversy. Everyone seems to agree. Sure, you can have the national anthem at the end. But, you know, I can get rid of that.
Personally, I think that we should get rid of our national anthem, which is a bit shit. And, well, the only time I've ever seen the national anthem performed in a way that actually felt really rousing to me is...
And Flea did a bass solo. I know that was the American one. Sorry.
Well, close to that.
Flea should do a bass solo.
Similar territory is the Queen Live from Wembley concert that they recorded in 1986, I think. Ends, as I think all Queen concerts do, or did, with the national anthem. And then Freddie Mercury sort of stomping around the stage in a very Freddie Mercury sort of way. And that's the only rousing performance I've ever seen of the national anthem. And all the Queen fans singing along. So I've always thought, maybe our national anthem, we should give that to Queen. And you know, Adam Lambert now can stomp around on stage in an inappropriate way. And then we have Bohemian Rhapsody as our national anthem.
Well, surely Bohemian Rhapsody is already the unofficial national anthem.
Because, you know, British people know the words to Bohemian Rhapsody. And that would be good, wouldn't it? If the last night of the proms, I mean, who cares? I mean, I would even forgo Land of Hope and Glory if we could end with a rousing orchestral performance. Everyone wave, they can wave their flags to Bohemian Rhapsody. That would be a much better end to the BBC's series of classical concerts each year.
Why does it even need to have the same songs at the end of every year? Why? What? Just because people have done it a lot. I mean, it's not, they haven't even done it every year. It's just they've done it a lot. But so? Change things. Tradition's rubbish. Well, I just realised we've done this in the same format quite a lot of times and I can't be bothered changing the format. But I don't know, this is working. No one's complaining about this. As soon as we get complaints about this, don't write in. I'm not going to give you the email address at the end of this episode. Yeah, basically, Setlist will not cow to the right-wing press, is what I'm saying, I think.
And I'm sure Boris Johnson would back us up that we've got a winning formula and we shouldn't be embarrassed about it. Yeah. And we should stick with it, I think.
Exactly.
Is the... yeah, and that's not the conclusion of this story. I'm not quite sure what the conclusion of this story is. Hey, Rule Britannia, Land of Hope and Glory will be part of this year's Last Night of the Proms, but without words, because, I mean, there's no one there to sing them anyway. Next year they'll be back. Who cares? Nobody really. But anyway, I think the conclusion is, you heard it here first, the Last Night of the Proms 2021, after COVID's over and the audience is back there, is definitely going to conclude with the new national anthem, Bohemian Rhapsody. And that's something I'm sure everybody in this country, including Boris Johnson, including the Daily Mail, can properly get behind.
Right, so we've sorted out all the problems in the country and probably the world now. So that's the end of this episode of Setlist. Do go and subscribe, rate and review now that you've got, I don't know, 2 minutes on your hands before something else happens. You can email us. No, you can't. I'm not going to say that because you'll just complain. And
now you've invited complaints.
Yeah, now I've invited complaints. With no emails. Just don't even review because I don't want people to complain in reviews. Subscribe. That's the important thing here. Hit that subscribe button only once or an odd number. Don't hit it twice because you'll unsubscribe. This is getting convoluted now. Subscribe to our podcast, please. 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 Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an unlimited production.